This is The Mountain Life, weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney, and today we explore creativity from the history of humanity to the chairlift of Park City ski resorts. First, we speak with Dr. Augustine Fuentes, chair of Notre Dame's Department of Anthropology and a National Geographic explorer who has written a book called Creative Spark.
And then, as we all know, Park City is full of exceptional people constantly performing innovative and creative endeavors. Bruce Kasanoff is one such person. He's a social media ghostwriter who pens business and technology articles for leading executive and entrepreneurs. His strength is simplifying complex topics and making them engaging. He has also recently created something called Chairlift Chats. Can't wait to hear about that. And we all know that riding the chairlift, that's where we come up with and encounter some of the world's most creative ideas, right?
Sometimes. Sometimes I just don't say a thing. I know you find that hard to believe.
I do. Bruce Kasanoff joins us in the second half of the hour. He'll also be one of the speakers at the Thin Air Innovation or the Thin Air Festival next week here in Park City. Stay with us. This is The Mountain Life.
Hi, this is Chris Eggleton.
And Chris Retzer of Destination Hotels Utah, proud sponsor of KPCW.
Since 2005, we've provided nightly rental, retail, and community management services
to New Park Town Center, Prospector Square, Empire Pass, and Toohey.
More information about Destination Hotels Utah is at dhutah.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with our guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs are available at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, our creativity is responsible for the world we live in on just about every front, every facet of our lives. Creativity, imagination, and collaboration fuel human evolutionary development. That's what our first guest says. He's Augustine Fuentes of Notre Dame University. He argues in his new book that's called Creative Spark, How Imagination Made Humans Exceptional, that your child's finger painting comes essentially from the same place as innovation in hunting and gathering millions of years ago. He takes us through stories of our ancient ancestors' creativity and how those same patterns are reflected in modern behavior. Augustine Fuentes is a National Geographic explorer, and he also chairs Notre Dame's Department of Anthropology. We're pleased that he joins us by phone. Welcome, Augustine Fuentes, to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I have to kick this off by asking you how one becomes a National Geographic explorer.
Well, I did it by running around after monkeys and people in jungles and cities across the planet. They seem to like that, and working with National Geographic is a good time.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny.
I was going to say, weren't you just running around in jungles with monkeys?
I was not given that moniker, a National Geographic
maybe
explorer.
Maybe that doesn't happen when you have surf sessions and yoga retreats right next door.
Well, something to aspire to. So, Augustine, I love whenever there is reflection upon what sets us apart as humans from other species. And your twist is a new one. I mean, I've heard before about, you know, our ability to have self-awareness, to emote, to have judgment. But this was a new one, the creativity piece. So talk about that, if you would.
Well, we always think humans are really different, and we are in many ways, but we're just as importantly really similar. Everything that you just brought up, self-awareness, the ability to emote, many of these incredible capacities, even to make simple tools, other organisms do that. But there's something really amazing about humans. I mean, we all know this. You can just look around the world and see how much humans have impacted it. This creativity, this ability to go from what is to what can be, this ability to use imagination, to collaborate, to make that imagination reality, that's something that's really distinctively human.
Excellent. And so what was the catalyst for writing this book and for going into creativity? And then that bridge between creativity and collaboration, that one's really fascinating as well.
So it's been 28 years now that I've been conducting research on human behavior, primate behavior, human evolution, human biology, all of those kind of related topics. And what it revealed to me is just how much humans have in common with other primates and other animals, but at the same time, it just became resoundingly obvious there really is something truly distinctive about us. So when I look at all of my work and all of the other work out there, the data are unequivocal. We're neither the nicest species nor the nastiest one. We're not entirely untethered from our biological nature, nor are we slavishly yoked to it. I mean, basically, we are shaped and distinguished by our creativity, and that's evident in the tools we make, in the kinds of work we do together. Really watching people and looking at our biology tells us that we're wired to work together, and that when we work together, we shape the world in a way that nothing else can.
So, Augustine, the creativity and the collaboration that you speak of, and you just said that we're hardwired for that. And I mean, I'm thinking that at some point in your studies of anthropology, you've gone back and looked at humans from the beginning. And it seems like maybe, you know, at some point there were simple solutions. You killed to eat. You did whatever you did to survive, and then those simple solutions no longer existed, and there was, out of necessity, a reason to be creative, to problem solve, to come up with new out-of-the-box options, as we would frame it today, but you could frame it, you know, all the way back to the beginning. No more simple solutions, more complex issues requiring more creative solutions and more collaboration. So I'm wondering, is it something that we all have within us that just needs to be triggered, or was it something that was learned and acquired?
Well, we all have it in us, and we learn and acquire it. Going back 2 million years ago, our ancestors were hairless, fangless, clawless, toothless, very short, naked apes, or ape-like things, with some sticks and stones. So you're right. They initially sort of did what other things did to make a living, but it became very, very clear that that wasn't going to cut it. So they started working together, as you pointed out, and that sort of encouraged the spark of creativity and made it blow up into a full sort of fire. But I think we don't recognize what creativity is. It's not a private endeavor that's like one person or a simple group of people have. It's not just about genius in the arts or sciences, and it's not even really just about artists or celebrities. I think we need to recognize that creativity is in all of us. When we collaborate, work, strategize, imagine, or even just when we hang out with friends and family, our bodies and minds benefit. That's because part of the success of our species is the capacity, as you pointed out, to meet challenges not just by responding to them, but by working together to creatively imagine new alternatives. Now, that doesn't always work, right? Failure is a big part of creativity. But over the last 2 million years, we've shown we're pretty capable of imagining and making the world the way we want it to be.
Well, and that, let's take that concept and apply it to our current situation, our current world, where you just said that, you know, at times we separate out people and we say, well, this person's an artist and this person's creative, and without recognizing that we all have some component, maybe even the same component of creativity that exists within us, and yet we continue to segregate people as opposed to being completely inclusive. And is that part of what you are presenting in your book for people to take away, is that if we could become more inclusive and recognize our commonality, that we would achieve more?
Yeah, even if we just recognize on a daily basis how creative and collaborative we are, whether it's in the physics labs, the artist studios, the restaurant kitchen, the mechanics garage, the corner cubicle, even a single mom figuring out how to make a small paycheck last until the end of the month. All of that's tapping into this capacity, creativity. And so if we recognize in ourselves individually the capacities we have, and then recognize that when we combine those with others, we can do more, I think that's a really good sign and a hopeful one. Now, that's not to say that creativity doesn't have its dark side as well, because there's a lot of bad things that can happen when humans get together and do stuff.
Yes, and part of this, you know, going back to what Tim just started to mention about the divisiveness of creating categories and segregation and looking at race and gender. Right. Talk about that if you would. That's really fascinating.
So we know that race and gender are what we call social constructs. That doesn't mean they're not real, right, and they don't have biological impacts, but they don't emerge on a one-to-one ratio from our biology or our bodies. Gender is a good example. I mean, they're male and female are two sexes, but the current gender roles that we have today are not the same gender roles that every society has, nor are they the same gender roles we saw in the past. In fact, we know from the archaeological record that what we think of as sort of male and female, right, guys hunt and females cook and take care of the kids or something like that, the evidence for those clear, distinct differences in male and female don't go back that far. The further back you go, the less clear these gender patterns are. That doesn't mean there wasn't gender. It just means it probably wasn't the same as it is today. And that can tell us a lot. As we are sort of confused in our world now about gender, gender changes, and understanding that it has changed over time and will change in the future will probably get us away from being so worried about who uses which bathroom.
Yeah. Well, compare that then to an animal species, for example, because that's where I find it confusing, that there are specific gender roles. I mean, how do they evolve and change in animal species versus us?
Well, in animals, they have sex and sex roles. We have gender. So humans have taken this incredibly complex, very social mammalian thing of having two sexes and having complicated sexuality and sexual relationships and behavior between individuals, and we've layered on it assumptions about what males and females do, how they should react in society. We give them different roles and different patterns and processes. So gender is our sort of way of thinking through in a much more complex way what sexes could do in society. Whereas for a female monkey, she's a female monkey. There's a couple ways to be a female monkey, but there's many, many, many more ways to be a female human or to be a feminine human, and that isn't always correlated with your sex.
Well, and thus, Augustine, that's the application of a creative narrative over a you know, sex role, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, that's the layering on, and that's where it gets us possibly into some really creative, wonderful solutions and possibly into some very frightening aspects of the human condition.
Absolutely. Look, sex for humans is messier than for any other animal. So sexuality and gender are even more complicated. That's a wonderful thing, as you point out, because we can create all these kinds of outcomes, but it also constantly provides us with complexities and problems that we have to overcome. I think this human capacity to be creative socially, cognitively, theoretically with how we envision the world, how we use our imagination, is an incredible power that we have, but it makes it very complicated. The whole idea, and you said on your leading up, you're going to talk something about lift talks or sort of while you're on the ski lift.
Chairlift conversations.
Chairlift talks. Sounds fantastic. Sort of going up there, that capacity to look at others, to look at the world around you, and to let your mind sort of run with imagination about gender, about life, about the way things should be, that's an incredible capacity, and we underplay how it can be deployed in our daily lives.
You know, and I'm a lot of the world would be so simple if it were black and white, right? And then there's this area in between the black and white, which is the gray area. And there's something to be said for clarity, but it's hard to achieve clarity in the gray area. And yet the gray area is this area that actually is most conducive to problem solving in different ways and nurturing creativity. And without it, you wouldn't get the benefits of creativity. And yet it would be so simple to be living in an absolute world.
Absolutely. And I want to emphasize here, the book contains hundreds and hundreds of references. I draw on hundreds of studies from human biology to archaeology to human evolution. And I think when you come with this idea that there's creativity and complexity, people are like, oh, well, you're just sort of being out there in the humanities and whatnot. I'm actually a scientist. And it turns out that gray area is where humans really do best. And so understanding the complexities of our biology and our evolutionary histories and our day-to-day lives all together forces into the gray area, forces us away from dualism, right, black or white, and just asks us to say, well, what's going on and how can we best understand it? I think sometimes simple answers might be really appealing, but when it's about humans, they're usually wrong.
So that leads me to ask you one final question about the gray area. Can you achieve clarity in that gray area?
Yes, yes. So the way you achieve clarity in the gray area is starting from the point where diversity is the norm. There's a bunch of potential options, that failure in whatever you're trying to do is one of those options, and it's going to happen a lot. And that through collaboration, working with others and thinking through your past, your present, and what you want in the future, you can narrow down this range of possibilities from a ton to a few. That's the kind of clarity we're looking for, not the absolute right and the absolute wrong, but understanding what our biology, what our history, and what our creativity enables us to do by ourselves and together.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Agustin Fuentes. He's the author of the book, The Creative Spark: How Imagination Made Humans Exceptional. Agustin, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke with the director of the Center for Compassion at Stanford University, Jim Doty. And he was talking about how it's our natural, how our species has evolved to have compassion and empathy at the very core. And yet you suggest in your book, when you talk about the four big misconceptions of human evolution, that we aren't necessarily caring, altruistic, cooperative, and maybe compassionate?
Well, we are, but that's not who we are at our core only. Let me explain. So it turns out that there's good evidence for compassion deep in our lineage's history. We've been around, our lineage at least, for about 2 million years. And despite what a lot of people think, there's more evidence for caring and compassion in the fossil record than there is for smashing each other over the heads. Now, we did smash each other over the heads, but just not as much as we took care of one another. So that's true, right? That's supported by the evidence. But what I'm arguing, and what I think is really important, is everyone thinks this compassion is always this positive, great thing. Well, let me present a scenario. It turns out in warfare, which armies win? It's not the most aggressive, the most violent, the most angry. It's the most cooperative, the one who has great compassion for their fellow soldiers, and the one who coordinates best. So this same capacity that we have to care for and be good to others can also be the way in which we can contribute to and commit the most atrocious violence.
So it's more about who you have alliance with than who you're fighting against.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's so one could argue that capacity to really bond together, to really care for one another, is very deep in our lineage. It just doesn't always mean the great things that everyone thinks it does.
Talk about some of the other misconceptions of human evolution.
Well, a really common one is that males have this sort of inner demon, that males are just prone to aggression and violence, and that females are just about caring for babies. That's a very, very common one, and there are little roots of truth in there. A lot of more men are in prison than women, and women give birth and men don't. But if you look at our biology and our physiology, you'll find that there's no particular evidence for genetic or physiological underpinnings that make males more aggressive. And more interestingly, recent work demonstrates that both males and females have the same physiological responses to infants, the same hormonal responses, the same bodily responses that suggest a very deep evolution of both males and females, young and old, caring for infants. Now, females give birth and lactate, males can't, but that doesn't mean that caretaking and a bodily response to infants is not a common human thing. That just challenges those simple assertions about what men and women are.
You know, Agustin, I'm thinking in terms of our world and how I have this perception, and I think it's kind of a common perception, that things are becoming increasingly complex, and and we get a sense that maybe even increasingly overwhelming, but it doesn't seem like things are getting simpler. It seems like they're getting more complex, and we're dealing with more issues, and we have more stimuli, and we have more distractions, you know, with our phones and whatever it is, but it's creating a lot of pressure, it seems, and we're seeing that pressure bubble up in different ways. But maybe that's a misperception, or maybe that is the future of the world. And I would make the case, and tell me if I'm right or if you believe I'm right, I would think that you would agree that it's going to require increasing creativity and increasing collaborativeness. And that's why we're seeing a transformation in the type of education models and the students that are going to probably be the most successful, even in the future definition of success from a career standpoint. It redefines all of that.
I agree with you completely. This complexity is part of our history. It's been ratcheting up much more so recently than in the past, but it's the way we've dealt with the world. We create more complex problems, and then we create more complex solutions to those problems. But you're right, because the way we teach students, the notion of individual genius of like, oh, well, here's the head of the class and here's everyone else, and that doesn't really work anymore. Working in teams, collaborating, different individuals with different skill sets, getting together to solve increasingly complex problems, that is exactly what the future looks like. And we know that. The business world knows that. The educational world knows that. And we actually know that in our daily lives.
And so are we trying to catch up with what we know in the real world? I mean, because you look at some of those companies out there, the Silicon Valley companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, and they've created a whole new paradigm of what it means to go to work and how you function in work. And I would say that it exemplifies what you've described. And yet we have sort of the legacy of the traditional model that's still clinging and hanging on. And, you know, it's across the board. I mean, we still think that for some reason the coal industry is going to come back when fossil fuels are an obsolete and antiquated fuel source.
Well, we love to hold on things that we know already. We're afraid of novel things, even though our sort of successes as a species have been challenging those novel things. But I dispute a little bit here. I think Google and a lot of these tech companies and a lot of sort of contemporary classrooms are actually going back to the future. They are looking back into our past and recognizing that it has been through this collaborative, this multimodal way of getting together and bringing our different unique experiences to the table together. That's actually been extremely successful. That's what we see in the past. We are just in a period, I think, especially this last century and the post-World War II buildup, the industrialization, and then the kind of industry and economy that we had, it has really, really shifted us towards the individual and away from the collaborative. And I think the collaborative is coming back.
Boy, I hope so.
Well, I mean, if it doesn't, we know what's going to happen. I mean, we are at a point of sort of social, climactic, economic, and political sort of breaking points. We've put ourselves here. We have the capacity to ameliorate it, to fix it, to move beyond. But we also have the capacity to really put ourselves in even worse situations.
Augustine, talk, if you would, about other times where we've been on this precipice, where it's kind of like we come to a parting of ways, where we're either going to go towards our own human evolution and creativity, collaboration, or we're going to let fear, stagnation, holding on to the past dominate how we interact. I mean, where else in history has that happened?
Let's go back 10 to 12,000 years ago to some of the early farmers in a couple different places of the planet. They finally had fascinatingly settled down in an area, figured out how to tweak the bodies of some plants or animals in particular ways, and they really made massive investment in that one place, so much so that they gave up a lot of the other kinds of food ways they had, and they're focusing just on this one thing. Guess what happened? They started getting sick. They were living much shorter lives. It looked like a really bad investment, this whole agricultural thing. The archaeological and fossil evidence show us that. But they stuck with it. They continued to tweak, they continued to modify, they continued to collaborate. Many of them failed, but enough of them succeeded as groups that they pushed forward, and now agriculture, domestication, is the entire landscape of the human experience. So we face these kinds of battles where it looks like our choices might be really bad, but we found innovation, we found collaboration, and we've used our imagination to move forward on that. And I think the early agricultural settlements are a great example. We always wonder why they stuck with it. But humans are pretty tenacious when they want to be.
So you talk about that, where we may be more narrow-minded, more focused, perhaps even more xenophobic. But talk about other times in history where we may have, for some reason or another, had a marked lack of collaboration and creativity.
Well, I think really if you look at the ways in which the emergence of the what we take as normal countries now, large economic nation states, things like that, and even what we were just saying about the last century, the focus on individual success and individual genius and creativity has robbed us a little bit of our capacity to create. So if as a kid, all children finger paint, right, as you said in the intro, there's this sort of playing with the imagination. We have, especially in our society, as people grow up, really discouraged imagination, really discouraged dreaming. And we find that that's had some pretty negative impacts, the focus exclusively on the individual, and the idea that adults don't imagine, play, or dream, I think has had major deleterious impacts on our capacity as a species, and especially here as a nation.
Augustine, you've spent a lot of time studying the past and creating a narrative and looking at evidence and supporting your narrative through data and research and evidence, scientific evidence. I'm going to ask you to look at the future. Do you ever do that? Do you ever speculate about the future? I'm sure you do. You're creative and imaginative. You must.
Yeah, of course. I mean, one of the things of being a scientist, right, is being whether in the lab or in the field collecting data and then analyzing those data. The question is always, what's next? You know, now that I know this, what's next? Where is it going? And so, you know, obviously writing this book, doing the work that I do, my question is constantly, what's next for our species? What's next for us in this giant evolutionary story? And I think we're at a crossroads. I can see equal opportunities for horrendous outcomes and amazing outcomes. It's not going to get simpler. We're not going to get rid of inequality and injustice, but we can manage both of those things in ways that are good for us and, more importantly, in some ways, for all the other species on the planet and the planet itself. We have the capacity, and there's a bunch of options for us to do this, but there's also options to go the other way. I think we're at a fork in the road.
Well, and I have to ask you this one last question. I would imagine, being a professor at Notre Dame, you have the opportunity to do research on your students, and you've done that over a period of time, and it's kind of a snapshot in time. But are you encouraged with the interaction, the questioning, the creativity, the collaboration that you see within your sample group of students over a couple of decades?
I've taught at both public and private schools, right, large and small, and I have found some incredible optimism in the youth that I've worked with in the last 20, 25 years in their ways they think about race and gender, for example, a much more open understanding, a much more engagement. But I'm a little depressed, though, by this sense of a lack of creativity in some areas, a kind of fear of failure, a fear of pushing beyond sort of the minimum that's expected or the norm. I'd like to see a little bit more fearlessness, a little bit more creative exuberance than I do. So there's good and bad. I am optimistic, though, because, you know, we have to teach kids how to hate. We have to teach kids to fear failure. We have to teach kids not to dream. And if we stop doing that, right, if we actually encourage the dreaming, the compassion, and the working together, and the lack of a fear of failure, I think we're in much better shape.
Have you ever given an A for failure?
No, but I have learned from failure. So, for example, I'm a professor, a full professor at the University of Notre Dame. I almost failed out of college my first semester. I got straight C's.
Best lesson
and
ever.
It taught me something.
Well, there's something we have in common.
Oh, so perhaps that's where all of this now new, you know, teachings, workshops, books written on resilience, grit are coming into play. So it all comes full circle.
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping people take it seriously, though. To take it seriously, it means taking responsibility for your own creative spark and attempting to do something with it and with others. Sometimes it's easy to sit back and just say, well, it's not my job to be involved. But as a human being, it actually is your job to be involved. So we all share some of that responsibility and the capacity.
That's right. Augustine Fuentes is a professor at the University of Notre Dame, a National Geographic explorer who's written this wonderfully fascinating book, The Creative Spark, How Imagination Made Humans Exceptional. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And it's The Mountain Life. Good couple of conversations. One we're about to have, also about creativity, and chairlift chats. Bruce Kasanoff. When we return, stay with us. It's The Mountain Life.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Experience the ride of a lifetime on the Comet bobsled ride at the Utah Olympic Park. Our professional pilots take passengers on a thrilling ride down the 2002 Olympic track. In less than a mile, you'll rip through curves, hitting top speeds like an Olympic athlete. It's adrenaline rush not to be missed. Reservations required. Details and restrictions are available online at utaholympiclegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a KPCW supporter and a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Just had a great conversation with Agustin Fuentes. His book, The Creative Spark, How Imagination Made Humans Exceptional.
That was fun.
That's really interesting. It gives me great hope for mankind. Just like our next conversation will. Our next guest, Bruce Kasanoff, is one of those guys you hope you can find on a chairlift because the conversation will always be fascinating. In fact, one of the many sidebars in Kasanoff's life is an actual thing. It's called chairlift chats. He'll tell us about how he brings that to his over half a million LinkedIn followers. Kasanoff calls Park City home most of the time. He's a social media ghostwriter who pens business and technology articles for leading executives and entrepreneurs. He's also the author of a book called How to Self-Promote Without Being a Jerk. I just love that. Yes, for those people who hate to self-promote, but, you know, we all need to know how to do it anyway.
What about the people who like to self-promote, Bruce?
Try not to encourage them.
Right. Bruce Kasanoff is also one of the speakers at next week's Thin Air Festival. He joins us now in the studio. And good morning to you, Bruce.
Good morning, Lynn and Tim. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, I do have to start by asking you about your book, How to Self-Promote Without Being a Jerk. I love that. And especially as the mother of college age kids who are both, you know, first trying to get into college, then right. trying to get their internships, and now trying to get a job. You just got to really drive that home. I'm going to buy your book for them.
Mm. Yeah. So it came out of what I write about on LinkedIn and Forbes is kind of doing well by doing good. How do you, you know, serve people? You know, how do you help others as opposed to, you know, okay, I want to sell this. I want to, you know, and the people who are more inclined to be of service to others tend to hesitate to, you know, to, well, you know, but I'm really good at this. And they don't like to say that, and they don't like to necessarily go out and sell. But those that can muster that energy, they're the best of all, because they actually want to help you, and then they acquire the skills. And so I just thought it was, you know, I basically collected all my different themes into a kind of how-to.
And so you wrote this book. It started off as an article, I believe.
Yeah.
And you have this tremendous following on LinkedIn, over 500,000 followers. And this is sort of how you've gotten a lot of your forward momentum is yeah. by blog posts or mm-hmm. articles. Talk about the spectrum of things you write about.
As I said, it's mostly doing well by doing good, bringing out talent in other people. One of the things that I do, which to me seems natural, but it most people don't do it, is I pay a lot of attention to how people react. So, for example, the How to Self-Promote Without Being a Jerk was an article I wrote, and it got a huge response. And I read every single comment anybody ever makes, and then I get my ideas many times from what people said. So, you know, when I saw the number of people who started saying things like, you know, I just don't feel comfortable, or, you know, so for example, people won't even tell the truth because they're so hesitant to self-promote. So they have an achievement and they downplay it. They say, well, yeah, I'm pretty good at that. Well, no, you were number one in your whole department. Like, well, yeah, but And so then I just respond to it. And on social media and in general, people tend to, the people like to talk, but they don't listen. And they don't, so, and to me, when you don't get that feedback, you miss so many opportunities to, well, how do I connect with somebody? How do I get a good idea? How do I know what to keep talking about and what to say? Well, nobody cares about this. So that's all I do is I just keep, you know, listening.
So you're unlocking those locks that keep people from achieving things. And for me, the easy one to focus on or to use as an example is public speaking. Mm-hmm. People are petrified in general to public speak. Very few people find public speaking. I don't have any research to back this up, but just
I can
from,
tell you it's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, if people could embrace, I guess, their fear and unlock that fear and feel comfortable or comfortable enough to step into the realm of public speaking, think of what could happen.
Right, right. What you have to do is, to a certain degree, turn your weakness into somewhat of a strength. I'm not saying become a public speaker if you hate to public speak. My wife said, so I met my wife through Toastmasters. We went to college together, and I was assigned to kind of critique her. And she just giggled the whole way through. And she's not a giggling person, but she was so nervous that she just couldn't stop. And, you know, and today she's a pretty accomplished public speaker. And so she realized, you know, I either am going to plateau in my industry or I have to figure out how to do this. So, you know, whereas I might come in and say, what do you want to talk about? You know, and she would script out. And so you learn a strategy that for me, if I'm prepared, I can speak, or, you know, or if I have a friendly face to focus on, something, you know. And so I just think, you know, I believe that people have a much greater ability to change than they recognize. And so I would write about a topic like that, like if you recognize it's just a question of what price you want to pay, then you can change. So if you say, well, okay, I'm going to get over this, I don't like having a severe weakness or fear, well, then you go to Toastmasters and you work on it, or whatever else works for you.
And is there a difference, and this might be a little too nuanced, but is there a difference between becoming accomplished at something and actually stepping into a realm of enjoyment? Is there a line there, or does it matter?
I mean, yeah, I'd like to think that people have purpose, and I'd like to think that, you know, I'm not saying everyone has their own perfect thing, but yeah, I mean, I would not find it very appealing. I don't think you guys would either if you're constantly fighting your nature. So you figure out, for example, I prefer to have a discussion. I'd rather lead a group, like a thing where I'm talking to other people, you know, than to be the keynote speaker. You know, I've done that. I can do that. I don't want to be just, okay, you know, an hour of Bruce. It's just not, you know, Tony Robbins can do that. I don't want to do that.
We have found on this show that doesn't work so well. An hour of Lynn and Tim just goes nowhere.
Tony Robbins.
We try.
Keep practicing, yeah.
I want to go back to something that you talked about a minute ago, which is that every article that you write or that you post on some public forum, you read every comment,
right,
every post after it. And I think that's fascinating because many of us who are in a sort of a public forum, we avoid reading any of those. And I think a lot of it is, you know, fear of rejection, mm-hmm, fear of not being liked, fear of not having, you know, of having something uncovered about us. And it's interesting to me that you read every single post. Now, a lot of times you're ghostwriting, so you're kind of writing, you know, it's someone else. It's not personal to you, but talk about that a little bit.
Well, so I'll just talk about when I write it, when my name's on it. You know, first of all, that is a competitive advantage. I don't care who you are. That's a competitive advantage. If you are someone who actually communicates two ways, then you're going to be perceived as smarter, more responsive, whatever. To me, it's just, it's input. So, I will admit that I wrote this week about IBM. IBM has decided, after being a pioneer in work at home, remote work, and they decide, no, you can't do that.
It doesn't
anymore.
Work.
And well, I would argue that it does work, but they decided not. And so that made me mad. So I wrote Sunday about it. Got a huge, I think, 1,200 comments so far. And And so it takes a lot of time to read 1,200 comments. But I've learned, you know, not only, I've also had emails that are private. And so learned, people have written me, here's what the real story is. Now, it may or may not be true. Some people have said, you're dead wrong. You know, what a, you know, stupid article this is, and you know nothing. And sure, there's something inside of me that says, well, you know, I want to, you know, I want to fight back. And I learned that I will respond to intelligent comments and constructive comments. If somebody says, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to write, you know. And so, yeah, you know, your blood pressure rises for a few minutes. But then I say, I'll let someone else, and usually someone else does, you know, jump in and say, well, that's ridiculous. You're not, you know, and so you don't have to personally respond. And so I just look at it as a positive meaning. I look for the inspirational comments. I look for people who are educating others and me at the same time. And I look especially for, is there another, you know, I want to write something tomorrow. You know, where's the idea or, you know, the inspiration for that?
So when we're looking for your articles, we find them in LinkedIn, or do you have a blog that is found somewhere else?
Right. So there's two. So I write on LinkedIn under my own name. So if you just looked for Bruce Kazanoff on LinkedIn, you'd find I've written 600 something articles on LinkedIn. And on Forbes, same thing. I write under leadership on Forbes. And so just do Forbes and Kazanoff and you find. I don't write anymore. I mean, I post a few things on my own blog. But mostly it's things that I want to make it easier for people to find. I never just publish there because today you have to use other people's distribution. It's just too hard to, you know, do it yourself.
So I'm wondering, as you're writing and then reading your 1,200 comments, how you find time to even go skiing, much less sit on a chairlift and have a conversation with somebody, which is another one of the wonderful things and fun things and invigorating things that you do.
Well, I got up at 4. So probably how you do it, too. So, you know, yeah, I mean, that's just, but I also find it interesting. So, I mean, that's the main thing is you have to find it interesting. I look forward to doing it.
Yeah. So chairlift chats, this is something new.
Yes, this year.
And you go about finding the most interesting people in Park City, and or do you just let it happen by chance sometimes?
Well, it's my subversive idea. So my idea is that by next year, if you know the most interesting people come to Park City, will start to call me. So right now I have to be proactive and track people down. But my goal for this year was to introduce the concept. So I had two goals. One was what I just said, in all seriousness. I'm, you know, third year here, and I wanted to get more involved and meet more people. Actually, three things. The second one is that chairlift is a unique, as you guys know, I heard your intro at the beginning of the hour, that it's a way to get people in a less formal, you know, conversation. You know, it's I love to... You know, even when I'm not a chairlift chef, I just get on, I go out for an hour and I talk up people, and you very quickly see this person wants to talk or, you know, stay away from me, and then I back off a little bit. So I'm trying to, I'll give you an example. Tomorrow I'm spending all day with I don't have permission yet, so I'll say a Fortune 10 executive. And I've been trying to talk to her for weeks, you know, and I get bits and pieces, and it's all pretty formal. I'm going to spend tomorrow with her and her husband skiing all day. You know, I'm going to really get to know this person and understand what she cares about, what her values are, you know, how she reacts if she's at the top of 9990 and it looks a little icy or bumpy or it's windblown or whatever. You can learn so much faster in that situation than you can if I'm, you know, getting your talking points from your PR agent. And so to me, it's a way to get past all of that stuff. And actually, you know, there's just not many opportunities to have that level of conversation in a really short period of time. I don't need, like I generally say, you know, can we ski 3-4 runs? You know, I'm not asking people for 8 hours of time. And it works great.
So that's one way to kind of package the chairlift talk, which makes a ton of sense because you want to be efficient with your time. You want to hit the right target. You know, you have people that you want to engage with.
Right.
But there's another way to kind of flip that. And I'm wondering if you've thought about it to somehow draw people to you. You'd have to, I don't know how you'd do that, but there might be a creative way of, you know, advertising or announcing who you are in the lift line and see who's drawn to you to ride the chair with you and share with you rather than you sort of, you know, going the other direction. Have you thought about it?
I could do the national ability, you know, thing and get a vest and say, you know, member of the press, come talk to me. And, you know, I'm not sure I want to go there yet, but, you know, it's interesting. There's one other thing I wanted to bring out about chairlift chats, and that is that it's tied into thin air, but it's also separate. That I've always perceived, meaning for 20 years, that places like Park City, Aspen's another place like that, are should be sources of content as opposed to just a place to come have your conference. And one of the things I'm trying to do with Chairlift Chats is to start that process personally. Like, I can't influence the whole world. I can kind of set an example maybe. But to me, there is something not just unique about the place and the way people interact here, but also, I mean, to your point, Tim, when you go, I always meet, I mean, significant, interesting people in a random, you know, six runs on at Park City or Deer Valley. And there are not, I mean, I come from outside of New York, and even in New York, it's not concentrated like that. It's, you know, and so to just simply be a place where, okay, what happens here, you know, not like Las Vegas, but kind of it's in the conference room, it's that montage, you know, you don't hear it elsewhere. And I think it should, I think there's a huge opportunity to go out to say, okay, well, here's, I mean, in a small way, I'm reaching a global audience with Chairlift Chats. I hope to reach a bigger audience. I hope to do it more. But the concept isn't, you know, it doesn't have to be just me. It could be any of us. You guys are doing it. But, you know, like every, I mean, if you took the show that you've done and then proactively put it out in the world, that's a really exciting proposition because it just leads to interesting interactions.
Well, that idea, that concept of a source of content as a community, that is, that's phenomenal. I love the way that that's phrased and what that brings into my mind. Really connects what we do in this community. We're trying to be progressive. We're trying to be a model. We're trying to lead. And why do we do those things? Well, and why do we have the ability and the platform to do it? Well, we have Sundance that comes here. Right. We had the Olympics. We have 150-year history of legacy back to a mining era. We have preserved our town. It all tells in a very amazing narrative. But that narrative is galvanized around a source of content. You're absolutely right. I've never thought about it that way before, but that's an amazing connection.
Right. So I'm trying to be subversive with thin air, which means that I'm trying to convince them that, you know, thin air is great the second year, next week, 3 days, but it should be more than 3 days. It shouldn't just be in April. It shouldn't just be, well, we can bring people in April and get, you know, fill up the hotels. And that's a great start. But it should be bigger than that. And what I was saying about in terms of content proactively coming out of Park City, that's the opportunity that I really, that's why I got involved in Thin Air, and that's what I'm trying to, you know, get more people to think about. You know?
Isn't it interesting how the most simple things that are right under our noses we often bypass, like a chairlift ride. And so it's such a simple thing, and I love how it will appeal on a mass scale to people because they love to be sitting in their offices in New York or San Francisco or London and reading about skiing because it's what they really want to be doing instead of being in that office.
Right, right. Well, and in the mindset. I mean, I have to think of a way to do it in the summer, you know, and which I will, you know, because it's just, you know, I'm preaching to the choir, but I think that, you know, I like to go up in the summer, ride Mid Mountain, and you get in Aspen Grove and you're out of your car for about 35 seconds, and it's transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept of, so I have a client of mine, he brings people into his house for these intensive, like, seven members of a leadership team. I'm like, we should do that here. You know, never mind, he's in Atlanta and it's a great concept, but, you know, do that here. We take a break and we'll go up to Mid Mountain. That's a really interesting concept. So,
well, how often have you been riding your mountain bike through an aspen grove and after about 10, 15 minutes or so, you suddenly realize that you have had this life-altering thought occur to you and you go, how did that happen? How did I get to that place? Because I want to recreate that all the time.
That's right.
So it's a combination of things, whether, you know, it's the aspen grove, it's the bike, it's the endorphins, it's
Well, so one of the things you asked me what I write about, one of the things I wrote about was your environment always wins. And this is a great example of if you take yourself or you take a team of people here, it's a different environment and it will change the way you think. And if you say, we'll save money and we'll just go into the, you know, we have a conference room here at work, you know, why should we do that? That is such a short-sighted thing. And here the environment is transformative, assuming that, you know, go to Main Street, have a nice dinner, but then get up in the mountain, you know, change the way that people interact.
Very interesting. Now, Bruce, tell us a little bit about, because we're running out of time, your role at the Thin Air Festival, which you alluded to, but give us kind of the details of what you'll be doing there.
So Thin Air is next week, Wednesday through Friday, big concert Friday night on Main Street. And so I'm doing a form of chairlift chats at the conference. And what's mainly going to happen is the speakers who best connect with the audience, I'm going to, in down the lounge in the chop house, I'm going to take, you know, for 15 or 20 minutes, one of those people at a time. There's literally a chairlift car in the lounge, or should be soon, and have a conversation that the audience can join into. So the whole point of it is to have that informal, you know, mm-hmm. So somebody was up on stage giving a keynote, interesting, but you can't really talk to them. So I'm creating opportunities to have a much more personal interaction.
Mm. Which lounge will you be in?
It's the chop house down there. The
Butchers,
yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
I just go where they tell me. Yeah.
Exactly. And it is a little confusing. You can go to thinairparkcity.com mm-hmm. to find the schedule right. And who's going to be where. Incredible people coming to town and sharing, expanding that content.
And tickets are available out to mm-hmm. locals yep. in Park City or anybody. There are tickets available.
Even out-of-towners can get
yeah,
tickets.
Even yeah, even out-of-towners. We'll let them in for this.
Excellent. So fun to speak with you. Come back next year, maybe towards the end of the ski season. We'll find out how Chairlift Chats has been going. And
or at the end of the summer. We'll see what you did over the summer. Yeah. That would be kind of fun.
I want to know, too.
I think perhaps you should start off a trail chat with Tim and me on our mountain bikes.
I'll do that.
Let's plan.
Yeah, deal. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Bruce Kasanoff. And we'll be right back after this.
I'm Darcy Olson, First Assistant Golf Pro at Park Meadows Country Club, proud sponsor of KPCW. We've expanded our junior golf program so more families can participate. We added Park Meadows Junior League, plus Park City Pinseekers PGA Junior Team, and clinics just for kids. More information at parkmeadowscc.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. I want to thank our underwriters.
Park Meadows Country Club, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Destination Hotels Utah, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
And thanks to our wonderful guest today. Great conversations. Augustine Fuentes of University of Notre Dame, The Creative Spark, How Imagination Made Humans Exceptional, and Park City's own Bruce Kasanoff, Chairlift Chats, and you can follow Bruce on LinkedIn. And what a wonderful assortment of topics he writes on. And this is The Mountain Life. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for national news from Washington.